about the speaker tonight, but then I'm not being real lovingly and tolerant and all that good stuff. You know, real quick, either you're really, really, really going to love him, or he is really, really, really going to make your inventory tonight. You know what I mean? But he's one of my best friends in the whole wide world. I love him. I love him with all my heart, and he carries the real message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm proud to share the firing line with him. Tom.
Everybody, my name's Tom Pick. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Love me or hate me. Can we settle that right now? This is my second time speaking here. The last time we were outside, and it was I guess the basement had flooded, and there was sewage. I guess it was maybe this deep or something. We couldn't have the meeting down here, so we had it outside, and I had a 40-mile-an-hour wind blowing over my right shoulder, and I think the only person that heard anything I had to say were, like, the people way over there. It's nice to be inside and indoors and no wind and no distractions. How many people in here are in their first couple months of sobriety? A whole bunch? Okay. Any of you guys that don't have sponsors yet, put your hands up. Don't be embarrassed. We're just kind of curious. So pretty much everybody here is sponsored up. Excellent. I came to AA back in 1987. I was about 23 years old, and I was at the tail end of a really hardcore losing streak. And I had reached a point where I didn't want to keep drinking, and I didn't want to stop drinking, and I was just screwed. And I tried doing some other stuff, and it just wasn't doing the job. And I was worn out, and I was beat, and I was done. And I got sober, and you know, a lot of people said, well, you know, you're so young. And I guess, you know, back then I was young. The next oldest people were in their 30s. You know, they didn't come in at age 11 like they do today. But I'm telling you, man, it's the coolest thing. And so I came in and I started going to a bunch of meetings like I was told to do. I was told to, you know, go to 90 and 90, and I'm sure there's no one in this room that hasn't heard that. And, you know, get a sponsor, go to all the dances, get involved, do some service work, make coffee, pick up chairs, play sober softball. I took it a step further, and I started dating AA women. And it is not as good as it sounds, let me tell you. And we're no better. And so I got involved, and I started doing all these things. And I got a sponsor, and we spent a little time together on the front end, and it was pretty much kind of a get-to-know-you kind of thing. And he was a mechanic, and I wasn't working at the time, and so I'd go hang out at his shop, and he had a lot of other guys that he was sponsoring hanging out up there, and it was just kind of like a bunch of us just kind of trying to keep each other sober. And when it came time to take the steps, we just kind of dabbled with the stuff. We were doing some step guides that his sponsor had made up, or that some treatment center had put out, or something, and so I tried taking the steps, and I'm just not getting the results that I'm thinking I should be getting, and I'm not getting much better. I'm sober, and honestly, I'm having some great days, but there's also some days that are just awful. And for the first 4 or 5 years, you know, I'm going to all these discussion meetings, and sometimes they were great meetings, and sometimes they were just a beating. And it was a lot of people talking about their problems and their issues and their child abuse and incest and all this stuff that's, I guess, it's important to talk about and deal with, but not in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're here to get drunk sober, not to fix everything else. We're not equipped for that. That was never our purpose, and it shouldn't be what we're trying to accomplish today. We're here to sober up drunks, but we were sitting in these meetings just kind of, you know, therapizing each other, and you know, I don't know. It was just nuts. And after about 10 years of this stuff, I'm getting real grindy, and I'm really starting to hate the meetings. I'd seen a lot of people go back out. I'd seen a lot of people die. And one thing that they seemed to all have in common was that they quit going to meetings before that happened. And so I decided, I don't care how bad I can't stand these meetings, I'm not going to quit. I'm going to keep going to these things. And, you know, I'm not going to make the mistake of not going and get drunk again, because I didn't, you know, I wanted to drink less than I wanted to stay in those meetings, or vice versa. I don't know if I said that right. Anyway, you guys know what I mean. So, you know, I'm going through this deal, and another 5 years later, and it's I'm in a discussion meeting. It was a men's meeting on a Saturday morning, and you know, you guys that have been around a long time, you know, if you got a bunch of time, you're getting called on. You're not safe in the meeting, and they called on me, and I don't know what the topic was. It had changed every time someone talked. It was a new topic, namely them. And it got to me, and I wasn't prepared. I hadn't worked up my act, and I didn't know what I was going to say, and I almost passed. And then I thought, well, what, you know, I'll just tell the truth. And I raised my hand. I said, look, you know, I don't want to scare any new people in here or freak anybody out, but I feel like I'm on this path where I'm going to drink again. And I don't think it's going to be today or tomorrow or this week, this month, and it might not even be this year. But I'm on this path, and I can't get off of it, and I'm scared, and I don't know what to do. And all these guys came up afterwards, and I mean, these are my friends. I'm not knocking any of these folks. And they all came up and gave me hugs and told me they loved me, and that they were glad that I shared, and they told me I needed to start, you know, coming early and making coffee and staying late and picking up coffee cups and straightening out the chairs and double up on the meetings and do all this stuff. And right when they said double up on the meetings, I was just like, man, if that's the answer, I'm dead. I was, you know, at this time I'm going to 3 to 4 meetings a week, and it takes every ounce of energy that I have to get there. And sometimes I'm showing up late and leaving early, but I'm showing up long enough to get my card punched so that I could say that I went to a meeting and I can add another meeting to the meeting bank. Fast forward a couple of years, I've got 17 years sober. Everything is great. Life on the outside is great. I've got everything managed just the way I want it. Got my own business, making a bunch of money. Great wife, great kid. Nothing's wrong. All the bills are paid. No significant debt that I can't handle. Everything is pretty much rock and roll on the outside. And the thought of drinking comes into my head. And so I remember everything that I've learned in AA for the last 17 years, you know. Think through the drink. Think about the consequences. If I were to drink, what would happen? And it's like the knowledge of that stuff would scare me into not drinking. And after hearing this stuff, you know, this has been my doctrine for the last, you know, 17 years at this time, because it's what we're saying in the meetings. It's all we're hearing in the meetings is, you know, don't drink no matter what. Think through the drink. Put the, you know, plug in the jug. All this other stuff. So it's like, okay, here's my time to try it out. And I start thinking about all the stuff I got to lose if I start drinking again. And I think about my wife and my kid and my business and my life, my sobriety date, my friends in AA. I've got a lot to lose that I do not want to lose. And I think about all that drama that happened back in the mid-80s, all the trouble and all the drama and all the BS that I went through that landed me here in the first place, and it was pretty clear I didn't want to relive that stuff either. And so the choice was pretty clear: don't drink. And within about half an hour, 45 minutes, I was getting loaded. And that stuff that I picked up in AA, all the stuff that I bet my life on, the meeting attendance, you know, getting involved, making friends, calling people in the program every day, thinking through the drink, it all failed to keep me sober. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, what the hell? That's not the word I was thinking, but it kind of means the same thing. You know, what happened here? And I didn't have a clue. And so I'm on this odyssey where I'm just lit up. I mean, you know, they say things get progressive and things get worse. I think to to the extent that my craving for alcohol, when I put booze in my body, the craving that it triggers was so much more intense that time than it was when I was 23 years old. I mean, it was absolutely insatiable. I couldn't get drunk enough. I couldn't drink and get any satisfaction or get that craving satisfied. It was just unbelievable. And through a rapid series of really bad things happening, ambulance rides and things like that, I ended up seeking some help, and I ran into a pack of Big Book Thumpers of all people that used to bore me to tears in the meetings, people that we used to make fun of because, you know, they seem to set themselves apart from everybody else, and they seem like these know-it-alls, and we used to, you know, make fun of them behind their backs and say nasty things about them. And the truth was, is these guys were happy, although they were rather isolated in our meetings and outnumbered. But that's what these guys were that were saving my life. And they started talking to me out of the Big Book. Now, I got a Big Book back in 1987, and I remember reading the stories out of it when I was in treatment. And I remember kind of skimming through it a couple of times, you know, since then. But the book never meant anything to me. I just didn't know what it was saying. See, I came to AA thinking that my problem was alcohol. I thought that alcohol caused my alcoholism. I thought that I drank so much that I got myself hooked on alcohol. And I thought that the problem was the drinking. And so, you know, my understanding of step one was maybe something like what a lot of folks in this room have experienced, where, you know, admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable, I thought that meant that I've got a drinking problem. When I drink, bad stuff happens. That's what step one was to me. And I thought I took step one when I went to that first meeting and called myself an alcoholic in front of a room full of people and got one of those desire chips. I thought that was step one. In fact, we would tell people that, you know, just by showing up in the meeting, you've taken step one. Just nobody makes it to AA by mistake. If you came to AA, you must be an alcoholic and all this stuff. And it was just so wrong. It was just bad information. And I took that same information, I passed it on to other guys, and I don't know about some of the groups you guys have gone to, but we weren't getting people sober very much. I mean, it was pretty much like the, you know, the worldwide averages, maybe 5 or 10% of the people were staying sober for any significant length of time, based on, you know, using the stuff that we gave them to try to stay sober. And people are dropping like flies. I mean, you guys have been around the program, you guys know. You know, I've been to the funerals and the wakes and all this other stuff. It's bloody out there. And so when we started going through this Big Book and started looking at what the real problem is and what the real solution is, you know, the lights started going on and all the dots started to get connected. And stuff started making sense, and they're just reading to me out of the Big Book. They're not making anything up. This isn't any theory. This isn't any special class that anybody went to. They're just talking out of this book that we didn't even bother to open up in our meetings, and they're talking about step one and what step one really means. And, you know, step one says that we're powerless over alcohol. We admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. If we're going to make that admission, we got to understand what it means to be powerless over alcohol. And we never talked about that stuff in our meetings. I had no clue what it meant. All I knew is that it was cool to say it, and everybody else said it, so I'm going to say it too. Straight up. For those of you that are familiar with the book, Bill Wilson, everybody know who Bill Wilson is? One of the co-founders of AA. He was in this hospital called Towns Hospital in New York, and he had a psychiatrist there named William Silkworth. And when these guys decided to get together and write the Big Book, they asked him to write a little piece to kind of lend some credibility to the book and also to maybe give a little medical explanation of this problem, because no one understood our problem back then. And so he wrote a little deal, and it goes into, he's talking about powerlessness over alcohol, and it's really kind of a two-part deal. It's, you know, we've got an illness of the body and we've got an illness of the mind. And he's talking about the body here. And what happens is when I drink alcohol, I trigger, something happens in my body. I'm not going to go into the science of it, but something happens that causes me to crave alcohol when I've got alcohol in my body. So when I drink, I trigger a craving for more alcohol. Then I drink more, and it triggers more of a craving, and you guys can kind of see how that kind of gets away from me after a few drinks. And I always wanted to be able, you know, to go out and have maybe 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 drinks and stop and go home and be responsible. And I could never pull it off. I could never call my numbers. I could never decide I'm just going to have a few drinks and stop. Every single time from age 11 or 12, every time I drank, I kept drinking and drinking and drinking until I passed out or fell asleep or got arrested or, you know, something intervened that wasn't my fault. And so Dr. Silkworth is talking about this stuff, and he says, in the doctor's opinion, he says, we believe, meaning us doctors, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. And then he starts to talk about this craving. He says, the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Normal drinkers, you guys know them, they put umbrellas in their drinks. They never crave alcohol when they put alcohol in their bodies. In fact, what happens with them, you know, alcohol is kind of like a poison that kills human tissue. And for them, their bodies protect them from this stuff. They start to feel nauseous. They start to feel lightheaded. They say things like, hey, I'm starting to feel this. I need to stop. They get nauseous. They stop. Whatever, you know, some little reason comes up for them to stop it, and they just stop drinking. They don't have this craving going on. It just does not occur with these people. So in step one, what we want to do is we want to isolate everything that's unique to alcoholics and doesn't occur with anybody else. If we're going to understand what it means to be an alcoholic, we got to get rid of all the fluff and get down to the truth. And the thing that's unique to us and never occurs with other people. And this is one of them. It says we can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And any NyQuil drinkers or Listerine drinkers, I never did that. It's got to be embarrassing. But this stuff is like 50 proof, 75 proof. And our bodies aren't responding to what's on the label. Our bodies are responding to the alcohol. And that's why we can't safely get away with that stuff, because it'll trigger that craving and we'll drink more Listerine or Sterno or vanilla extract or whatever. It's just crazy. Our bodies just respond to alcohol like this. Then it says, once having formed the habit and finally can't break it, losing their self-confidence, their reliance upon other people, the problems pile up and then become astonishingly difficult to solve. And I'm sure everybody in this room can identify with that, with those problems just piling up, and you're so engulfed in this craving for the booze that you can't do anything else until that gets satisfied. And with me, everything in my life just fell by the wayside because of my pursuit of chasing this down and trying to chase that sense of ease and comfort that I used to get when I drank. And then further down on the page, he tells us why we drink. And I've watched people just flounder and circle the drain in AA for decades, trying to understand why they drank, trying to figure it out, thinking that maybe it was because their daddy put them on the toilet seat backwards, or maybe because their mama had square nipples, or. Let's just figure this out and then deal with it so that we won't be hurting anymore. And the problem is they never get better. The stuff is always there, and what they're trying to do is trying to treat this from a psychological approach, which doesn't work for us. He goes on to say that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. No big surprise. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, and those injuries include things like ending up in treatment, DWIs, going to prison, losing jobs, losing relationships, they cannot after time differentiate the true from the false. It says to them their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And here's one of the big lines in the big book. It says they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Without a few drinks, we are restless, irritable, and discontent. Bottom line, we drink because being sober sucks. That's why we drink. Being sober just sucks. And without booze, I am unhappy, I am dissatisfied, I can never get things arranged in my life just the way I want them, and once I do, I'm not satisfied, and it doesn't matter if I'm driving a Cadillac or riding a moped, it just doesn't matter. I am unhappy, and I'm restless, and I always feel like I need to be doing something, and I can never figure out what it is I need to be doing, and I'm depressed, and I don't have any ambitions, And the only thing that fixes this is the booze. The only thing that gives me any solution is alcohol. And, you know, I spent a total of 3 years during my teenage years, during high school, in psychiatric hospitals, a solid 36 months, because of what people thought was my problem, depression and all this other stuff. And it was just a misdiagnosis. The fact is that it's the spiritual malady that caused everybody to think that I needed to go to these psych hospitals. And I would go into these places, and I'd be like the only kid that wasn't getting better. All the other kids are getting better, and they're doing their little therapy and talking about themselves, and they cry once a week and do all the stuff that we're supposed to do in therapy, and they're getting along fine. And the staff are talking like, to my dad, like, you know, Mr. Pick, he's a nice guy, and he doesn't cause much trouble, but he's just not taken to this stuff. And I would try my ass off to get right in these hospitals, and I was always just miserable, and it's because I was separated from the booze. The only solution I had was the booze, and I couldn't get my hands on it. And it just made me a really cranky guy. And I think if I hadn't discovered alcohol, I would have been one of these 14 or 15 year old suicides that you read about. It was just that bad. I was just that unhappy. And it wasn't caused apparently by anything in my life. It's just the way I was born. That's why we drink. You know, if this were just a deal with the body, if my body was my only problem, then staying away from booze would be the answer. You know, if you can't crave alcohol, and you can't overdrink if you don't put booze in your body. My problem is that in spite of the fact I'm separated from the booze, I do the most insane thing I can possibly do. Knowing the consequences, knowing what's going to happen, knowing the damage I'm going to cause, knowing the risk I'm taking, stone cold sober, I get drunk. That's the insanity that we're talking about in AA. And my problem is I've got a mind that cannot protect me from that first drink. On page 24, and you guys that don't have your books with you, when you next time you pick it up, go highlight this paragraph, because this is the one that tells the whole story. This is the death sentence in step one. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. With my body, I've lost power of control. I cannot control how much I drink. With my mind, I cannot choose whether I drink or not. I can't make a choice and then stick with it. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. It says we are without defense against the first drink. What this is telling me is that I cannot think through the drink. This is telling me that day when I got drunk with 17 years sober, even though I could remember all the bad stuff that happened and I could contemplate all the stuff that would happen, I couldn't bring it into my mind with sufficient force. And this means you're going to die. I mean, this is why people die of alcoholism, because you can give us any reason in the world and make it a damn good reason, and we cannot stay sober in spite of it. There's no hope in step one. It's not a hope step or a surrender step. It's an information step. And the information is your mind can't keep you from the first drink, and your body can't keep you from the second drink. That is it. And that means you're going to die from alcoholism. No one ever explained this stuff to me when I was new. We didn't talk about this stuff. They just told me to sit down and listen to people with 20 years talking about their problems. That didn't do anybody any good. Neither did it do the people any good that were sharing their problems. Trust me. Let me kind of paint a little picture, a little backdrop of what Alcoholics Anonymous was like back in the 1930s. I think it's important to do that because that experience is what gave us our big book, what gave us this text. This text was based on the experience of the first 100. In the foreword to the first edition, they even say, it says, we have Alcoholics Anonymous and more than 100 men and women who have recovered, not are recovering, but have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which I just talked about. It says to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. This book was written for no other reason than to show other people precisely how they have recovered, period. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. They're hoping, and they believe, that if you read this book and you understand what they're saying here, you're not going to have to try anything else to get sober. You're going to be convinced that this is the way, and you'll do it, and you'll be okay. And back in the 30s, they gathered this experience, and their success rates were just unbelievable. And they document this in the second edition. You know, 50 to 75, upwards of 90% in some places, of people that came and tried and maybe relapsed and came back and maybe it took them a few times. 85 to 90% of these people are getting sober and staying sober. It was unbelievable. I mean, we were getting written up in magazines and people were writing articles about us, and it was just unbelievable. And then today, I don't know what they're telling you here in this treatment center, but I can tell you in Dallas, Texas, you know, 7 out of 100 are picking up the one-year chips. That's terrible. And I think that pretty much is representative of what's going on around the country and around the world. There's some places where it's even worse, but I think generally speaking, that's a fairly decent number to use to get a picture of how well we're doing today. And the big difference is back in the day, they didn't have AA meetings every day, all day long. So that if you had a little problem, you could find any meeting at any time of day and take it there and deal with it. They met once a week if they did meet. They weren't even called AA meetings until the book was published because they named the fellowship after the title of the book. It's not the other way around. And so you would think that if we're going to call ourselves Alcoholics Anonymous, named after a book, then maybe we'd pick the damn thing up once in a while and see what it's got to say. You know? That ain't what we're doing. That is not what we're doing. And what they did was they went looking for guys to work with, and they cold called, and they called doctors and priests and anybody they could think of that could refer them to a wet drunk that they could approach and offer sobriety to. And they got on their feet and went looking for these guys. They did not sit in the card room at the AA club waiting for people to show up. They got off their butts and went and looked. And then when they found these guys, they qualified them. They found out if they were real alcoholics or not, and if they wanted to stay sober forever, and were willing to do what it took to do that. And if they weren't willing, or if they weren't real alcoholics, or they didn't want to stay sober forever, they dusted them and moved on to the next guy until they found the guy that met the bill. And then they would take this guy through the steps. And you know, some people think that they did it quickly. It just so happens that if you do it right, and yeah, I said that, do it right, because there's only one way to do it in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't take that long. We're talking a week, maybe 2 weeks. You know, step four, if it's taking you more than 2 hours to do a four step, you got bad instructions. This stuff does not take that long. And so it was possible to get these guys through the steps in a short amount of time. And then they would have this spiritual experience, which pretty much looks like what we read at the beginning of the meeting, the nine-step promises. Those aren't the promises in the program. Those are some of them from step nine, but there's promises all through this book for every step. And when you experience these promises, that's what the spiritual awakening looks like. That's what the entire psychic change looks like. And that's what happened with these guys by doing this work. And that's what happened with me, and that's what happened with guys that I've sponsored and guys that they're sponsoring. We get through this stuff, and we get it through it quick. And we catch fire with this stuff. You know, page 89, and you guys have been around a while. You know that we're pretty much all about working with other drunks. It kind of gets brought up once in a while. And page 89 in our book tells us practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. That means taking them through the steps. Why would I tell a new guy that he's got to wait a year or 2 years before he can do the thing that's going to ensure immunity from drinking the most? Doesn't that sound crazy? It happens all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not here to bash AA, because AA is between the covers of this book and it saved my life and I believe it in 100%. But I'm, you know, just between us kids, I'm going to tell you the truth. And I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of groups out there that you can go into and get told to sit there and wait till the right sponsor comes along and, you know, learn how to love yourself, and we'll love you till you learn how to love yourself and just work on yourself and all this other crap. And you got a 1 out of 10 chance of making it. And if you do these steps like they're directed in the book, you're going to make it every time. I've never, ever, ever seen anybody get drunk that has taken these steps following the instructions in the big book. I've not seen it happen. I've seen a bunch of people get drunk sitting in discussion meetings waiting for the miracle to happen. I got news. There ain't no miracle. A miracle ain't going to happen there. There's no power there. We read it and how it works. There's one who has all power. That one is God. If God has all power, then I don't have the power. The meeting doesn't have the power. The dances don't have the power. The trigger lists don't have the power. All this stuff that's designed to prevent you from the first drink is man-made stuff. And we're way beyond the help of other humans. Other humans can't help us. Things that they make up can't help us. It's all about getting to God as quick as we possibly can. And I thought that these steps were all about, you know, teaching me how to be nice and play well with others and kiss and make up and all this other goofy stuff, because that was just the impression I had. And my other impression is that the steps are something to do when something really bad happens in your life. Like if your girlfriend breaks up with you, or maybe a relative dies, then you do some step work, whatever that means. I thought that's what these steps were for. And what I never understood until I started studying the book was that these steps were designed, specifically to identify and remove all the garbage that's blocking us from God. All the things that are cutting us off from that relationship with Him. The ego, the fear, the resentment, the self-centeredness. All that stuff that's blocking us from that power that we have to have. And so we can get that spiritual awakening is what these steps are designed to do. And if you think about it, there's no way that these guys would have set up this program so that it would take forever to get to that power. Page 24 that I read a little while ago, the part where that tells us we can't think through the drink, tells us we got a week or a month before that memory phase. Some people it's 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. For me it's just a couple of days. I'm good for about 2 days and I'm drunk again. The day after the worst thing that ever happened after my drinking, it took me 18 hours to pick up another drink after swearing it off. The worst thing that ever happened in my life when I was drinking, 18 hours later I was drinking. That's how long we have. So if your truth is that your mind can't keep protect you from the first drink and your body can't keep you from the second one, then you don't have time to goof around. You really don't. You might make it a month or two, but the truth is that at some time you're going to need that mental defense like I did, and it won't be there. And the only way to get it is by taking these steps and getting that experience yourself. And the only way to keep it is by finding guys to work with and take them through the steps. And if you've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, you're ready to sponsor people. It doesn't matter if it takes you a week or 2 weeks. You're not going to be perfect at it. And your sponsor should probably get involved and help you all the way through. But if you're clear on this message, you can't kill anybody. If you're coming out of this book and following the directions in the book and following the directions in Chapter 7, working with others, you won't kill anybody, I promise you. And you'll have the most mind-blowing experience of your life. And it'll hook you and you'll get sucked into this thing. What'll happen to you is you'll be motivated to do this stuff. You know, right now I remember sitting in treatment thinking about working with others and spending time doing stuff like that. I was like, Jesus, I mean, I'm busy. I've got I've got TV shows that I'm committed to. You know, I like reality shows. Don't tell anybody. And they take up time. And I don't have time to be doing this stuff. And what happened was, to my surprise and to my delight, that because of that change in attitude and that change in thinking that happened as a result of these steps, man, I can't wait to go out and find guys to work with. And I mean, it's just the coolest thing in the world. And I promise you that it can happen to anybody in this room. There's no reason why anybody in this room can't be sponsoring somebody in the next month or so going through these steps. Honest engine. I'm not here to sell anybody any BS. I've seen both sides of this deal. I've seen both sides of it. And I've seen a whole bunch of people that thought that they were going to, you know, work on themselves and learn to love themselves, blow their brains out. And I've seen a bunch of knuckleheads that nobody had any hope for get this thing and have the coolest lives you could ever imagine. I've seen it not a million times, but 800,000 times I've seen it. I've seen it a bunch. And I was doing this meeting yesterday at this hospital that I go to, and we were talking about the steps. We're talking about step two, and you know, I want to make an observation. The graveyards are full of people who got stuck on the second step. Everybody gets stuck on step two, and my deal was is that my sponsor wasn't using this big book. Bottom line, wasn't using it, and he gave me these exercises to do that were designed to help me believe in God, so I could take step three and four and five and six. You know, it's like you can't turn the will in your life over to care of something you don't believe in. And so he had me reading out of this certain book, a chapter called Step Two, every day for 30 days. And if I missed a day, I'd have to start all over. So I had 30 days, and I lied about missing those couple days. And he gave me my next assignment. And I had to write down, I had to journal, every day before I went to bed, I had to write down everything that was different in my life because I was sober. And some of this was just chicken shit stuff. You know, I didn't give that guy the finger on I-35. And, you know, I didn't kill that lady with all the coupons at the grocery store. I'm scrambling. And so I do this thing. And 30 days later, I've got my little journal, and I guess maybe seeing it in black and white is supposed to help me believe in God, and you know, you can't deny it if you can see it on paper. I don't know what the theory was. And then at the end, I had to create my own God. God's pretty big. I don't know how to make a God. And I'm not sure that he's real impressed with me trying to do it anyway. But I come up with the usual stuff, you know, loving, kind, forgiving, funny, I mean, you know, just whatever. I just have to come up with something to get the assignment done. And I'm here to tell you, after 65 days of this crap, I'm no closer to believing God than the day I started. I'm just not there. And what the book tells us, it's a little bit different than what my sponsor told us. It's on page 47, there's a question in the middle of the page. And this is step two. And it says we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? That's step two. As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is well on his way. What that looks like, Let's say we take belief in God and put it on a 0 to 100 scale. Down here we got 0, over here we got 100. And 0 is I don't believe in God, and 100 is I'm positive there's a God. My sponsor is trying to give me these exercises to get me somewhere around here. What the book is telling me, what the literature, their experience is telling me, is I can be right here on 0. I don't even have to get off of 0. I can stay on 0. I just got to believe it's possible that maybe, kind of, sort of, I could get off of 0 just a little bit. Forget about getting down here. You don't have to get down here ever. You just got to believe it's possible to get off the mark. And if you can do that, you're in the club. You're ready for step three. There's no reason to be stuck on step two. I've had people that, you know, I'll ask, what step are you on, step two? A week later, what step are you on, step two? Like, can you maybe take 6 seconds and ask yourself the damn question and get on the step three? It's crazy out there. I feel like the guy, you older people, you listen to the soundtrack from Woodstock. You know that guy that pipes in talking about there's bad acid, go around, don't take the acid. I feel like that, you know, about AA, you know, stay away from this stuff, man. There's some bad stuff out there. But the truth is, there's some misinformation out there. And if anybody can get off, believe they can get off that mark, they can take the rest of the steps. We read how it works at the beginning of the meeting. It says God could and would if he were sought. It doesn't say God could and would if he were found. It says if he were sought. What happens is by taking these steps, you embark on the process of seeking God. Okay? Your belief will form, and your conception of God will form as you go through these steps. You don't have to make anything up. You know, it says, you know, your conception, however inadequate, if you have an inadequate conception of God, that's your conception of God. Use it. That's all you got to have. And trust me, if you're going to use a doorknob or a Dr. Pepper can, forget about it. I can take your Dr. Pepper can and crush it and throw it in the fireplace. You don't need a God as lame as that. Just trust that your belief and your conception will develop over time as you take these steps. Bottom line is, we don't need you guys hanging out in AA meetings, sitting in the back of the room waiting for the miracle to happen. There's a lot of drunks that are dying, a whole bunch, and there's not enough people to sponsor these guys. And what we need everybody in this room to be doing is to get a sponsor who understands this book and take these steps and have that psychic change and then go turn around and do it with other people. That's what we really need. We don't need to have people dying in AA anymore. You know, I'm foolish if I think that talking from the podium is going to change that thing. But the truth is, it's not going to change without strong sponsorship. And that's, you know, that means that we got a job to do. And we got a job to pull you guys into the vision and take you through this work and show you how cool it is and then teach you how to do it. You know, our job is to turn alkies into sponsors as quick as we can. Well, that is the end of my time, which is good because if I keep going, I'll start lying. Thank you guys for being here tonight. Thanks for listening. Thanks for not leaving. Thank you very much.